you read the bulletin, you'll know what my sermon title is, or if you heard Dan speak a minute ago, The Giant of a Man, David and Goliath. If you have your Bible, turn to 1 Samuel chapter 17. If you don't have a Bible, try to find one in the pew, because we're going to read a lot out of this chapter, so you may want to follow along as much as possible. Most of us know the story of David and Goliath, and so it's not going to be presenting to you a new story necessarily, but hopefully there'll be some things in here that you haven't thought of before. We'll present them to you in a way that will hopefully help you to come out of this with better understanding. 1 Samuel chapter 17, I want to begin in verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Soko and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in the line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with the valley between them. Now, it's very possible that the Philistine army was already aware of the fact that Samuel the prophet was not happy with King Saul. It's very possible they've known that King Saul has made God unhappy. And they're thinking in their minds, what a better time to attack the Israelite nation than now, with the lame duck king sitting on the throne. And I think they were very wise in deciding to attack now. Let's continue on. Let's pick up in verse 4. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Now you guys know I like kind of different names to name my children, for those of you who don't know. I didn't really consider Goliath too much though, but it would have been a good name. This man, it says, was 6 cubits and a span. That doesn't really mean much to us. We don't know what a cubit is necessarily, or a span. But we do have an idea. A cubit was roughly the length of your elbow to your fingertips. That leaves a little room, right? I mean, whose elbow to whose fingertip? But I want to share with you what some scholars think. Depending on who you want to read and who you want to believe, his height is estimated to be from 9 foot 9 inches up to, now listen to this, some scholars believe he was as big as 11 foot 10 inches. Now, if you can't see me over here as I walk back here, I'm sorry, but I want to do this just for a visual effect. I'm 6'2" tall. I measured yesterday. To the bottom of that overhang thing, that's about 10.5 foot. I'm 6'2". This man was roughly that height, give or take. He may have been a whole foot plus a few inches taller than that, or he may have been a little shorter. But he was a giant of a man. So his height was huge. Now, if you want to use some mathematical formulas, you can estimate what his body weight must have been. And using a formula we call the ideal body weight equation, being a man, his height, his weight would have been somewhere between 450 to 725 pounds. And that's if he's not extra muscular. He's a man of war. He may have been very muscular. This guy may have weighed as much as 800 pounds. That's bigger than any lion, and it's bigger than most bears. For those of you who are hunters, you'll know that most, if you get an 800-pound bear, you bag a big one. This man was tremendous in size. Not just big, he could have eaten Shaquille O'Neal. I mean, this guy's huge. Let's pick up again in verse 5. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs, and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield bearer went before him. So we know how much his coat weighed. His coat was approximately 157 pounds. That's just his coat. But he had other armor on as well. Some scholars have decided they wanted to figure out approximately how much the complete armor would have weighed. And according to Clark's commentary, it was about 273 pounds just for his armor. Then he had a 19-pound spear in his hand. So when he went into battle, he was carrying on him about 300 pounds. I'm guessing David was a smaller man, maybe 150 to 160 pounds. This would have been about twice the weight of what David weighed. And he's going into battle with this on him. That helps you know this man was not a skinny man. He must have been so big, so strong, so intimidating, that he can throw a spear that weighs 19 pounds. Anybody in here ever done shot put? you'll know that a 19-pound spear is not going to be easy to throw. And Goliath went into battle with this. And he wasn't even alone. He had another guy that went before him to carry his shield. Let's pick up in verse 8. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel. I'm going to stop and pause here real quick. Imagine this guy's size, and then think for a second if his voice was as powerful as he was. So not only is he tall and huge and intimidating, and as we're going to read in a second, he has been a warrior from his youth. This guy's voice must have been like thunder. And as he stood in the valley, this is what he shouted. Verse 8. Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourself and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, look at this, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. He's standing out there, he's making a mockery of the nation of Israel. Give me a man that we may fight together. Verse 11. When Saul and all Israel heard the words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Skip down to verse 16. For 40 days the Philistine came forward and took his stand morning and evening. For 40 days this man is browbeaten. This man is down, putting down your army, putting down your king, putting down your nation, and we're going to see in a minute, he's putting down your God for 40 days. Huge, intimidating man. But look at what the nation was doing in verse 11 one more time. When Saul and Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. You know, I can't say that I blame him. That's a big man. I want to read to you, because some other sources say that we have more to what the Philistine Goliath was saying than what's recorded in the Bible. And whether this is correct or not, I don't know. But some other historical resources add this, and I want to read to you what they add. This is the substance. Okay, here he goes. I am Goliath, the Philistine of Gath, who killed the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests, and led into captivity the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah, and placed it in the temple of Dagon, my God, and remained in the city of the Philistines for 7 months. Also in our battle, I have gone out at the head of the army, and we conquered and cut down men, and laid them as low as the dust of the earth. And to this day the Philistines have not granted me the honor of being chief of 1,000 men. And you men of Israel, what noble exploit has Saul, the sons of Kish of Gibeah, done that you should have made him king over you? If he is a hero, let him come down himself and fight with me. But if he is weak or cowardly, then choose a man to fight with me that he can come down. So Goliath is not, he's not a real pleasant guy to listen to, is he? He's making fun of everybody. He's saying, I killed your priests, two sons, Eli and Hophni and Phinehas. And we read about that in 1 Samuel 16. He says, I killed them. 1 Samuel 4, I apologize. He tells them that he killed the priest's sons. He says, I took the Ark of the Covenant. I put it in my God's temple. He says, and I'm a hero, and you guys have made your king Saul. You made him a king. He's nothing. If he's a man, send him out. And of course, we already know Saul is sitting in his tent, terrified of what's going on. Imagine yourself an Israelite. How would you view this? I mean, I don't know about you, but I think I can understand the Israelite's fear. Saul the king, he was supposed to be their leader. And he's sitting in fear. Why would anybody expect that his people would not have the same fear that he is? Why would anybody be bold when their leader is a coward? But all of a sudden, we're going to see somebody who's going to step on the scene who's not like everybody else. We're going to see a man who comes on the scene that's not afraid of this 10-foot or 11-foot, 600 to 800-pound giant. Let's pick up in verse 20. And David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with the keeper and took the provisions and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the encampment as the hosts were going out to the battle line, shouting the war cry. And Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. And David left the thing in charge of the keeper of the baggage, and ran to the ranks, and went and greeted his brothers. As he talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines, and spoke the same words as before. and David heard him. Let's stop there for a second. Fear's a horrible thing, isn't it? I've shared with you guys, those of you who know me well, you know I'm a coward, and I've shared with you many stories that prove I'm a coward. Not a brave man. Fear's a terrible thing. I can speak for that, because I've sat paralyzed with fear in my bed at nighttime, wondering what's going to come out of my closet many times. Last week included. So, you know, fear's a terrible thing. Fear paralyzes us, right? And the army of Israel was paralyzed with fear. But one man comes on the scene, and he's going to hear what the Philistine's going to say, and this man's not going to be paralyzed with fear. What is the difference between the Israelite men and David? I want to read to you an article. I'm going to read about two-thirds of the article, and it's fairly lengthy, so please bear with me. Please try to pay attention. This is from a brother in the church from Hamilton, New Zealand, named Rex Bates. And he talks about fear versus faith. And I want to read to you two paragraphs, so please listen up the best you can. I'm going to pick up halfway through the article. You and I know the foe equally well. That's fear he's talking about. We yearn to take our God at His word, and we long to make the precious promise ours. But often the cunning adversary sows the seed of doubt within our minds so that our best intentions dissolve in a sea of indecision. We know the promise, and my God shall supply all your needs, Philippians 4:19. But the tyrant whispers in our ear, what if? And our peace of mind disappears like smoke in the wind. With our intellect we grasp the meaning of our Lord's words, I will give you rest, Matthew 11. But fear is like a lead weight that threatens to drown us in a bottomless sea of anxiety and worry. The words on the sacred page tell us that God has not given us a spirit of timidity, but of power and love and discipline, 2 Timothy 1:7. But still, fear invades our soul by a dozen different doors. Fear of failure, fear of ridicule, fear of rejection, fear of change, fear of darkness, fear of crowds, fear of financial loss. The list goes on and on. And as the oppressive iron-fisted ruler squeezes the joy from our days, listen to this, fear is joined by guilt, because we know that in our heart of hearts that our joyless, insipid lives have no power to attract an unbelieving world. And that's true. If we, as Christians, live in a life of fear, and we're joyless walking through this world, how can we attract somebody from the outside? He continues on. The bad news isn't that fear's henchmen are guilt and despair. The bad news is that fear's henchmen are guilt and despair. The good news is that fear has an implacable enemy that stands with drawn sword to protect against the ravages of our foe. Its name is faith. Its source is the word of the Spirit. Its fruit is optimism, hope, and courage. Faith banishes fear. The Lord is my life and my salvation. Whom shall I dread? Psalms 27:1. You see, if we can but saturate our minds with such promises, then the ridicule of unbelievers and the rejection of men are powerless to harm us. Again, truly the antidote for our despondency. Our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. For our heart rejoices in Him. Look at this. Because we trust in His holy name. Psalm 33:20 and 21. Trust and joy are inseparable. Are you worried about the future? Listen to Isaiah 57:13. But he who takes refuge in me shall inherit the land and shall possess my holy mountain. Is the prospect of death a shadow upon your happiness? Listen to Paul. I know whom I have believed in, and I am confident that he is able to guard what I have entrusted to him until that day. 2 Timothy 1:12. Does the world appear to be out of control? Listen to Isaiah again. For the Lord of hosts has planned, and who can frustrate it? As for the stretched out hand, who can turn it back? Isaiah 14:27. Faith banishes fear. Let us saturate our minds in the promises of God, immerse our hearts in the faith that guards from fear, and place our plans in the hands of the one who upholds the universe with the word. David was different because he understood who was in control. He understood that God was the source of victory. He understood that God was the one who could protect him. God was the one who could deliver him. David was different because of that. The Israelite army sat in fear in their tents. The king of the nation sat in fear in his tent. But David was different. Let's look at verse 26. And David said to the men who stood by, what shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? David wants to know something. First of all, what's going to happen to people? What's going to happen to the person that defeats this Philistine? He doesn't say this with timid the timid nature. He doesn't ask us because he's trying to make himself look good. He wants to know because he's planning on doing it. Look at what he says at the end of verse 26. For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? David is mad this is happening. And I think he's mad at the nation of Israel. They're sitting around like a bunch of cowards. Let's pick up at verse 27. And the people answered him in the same way, so shall it be done to the man who kills him. If you want to know what he's talking about, skip down later on and read beginning in verse 24. Now verse 28. Now we're going to see here David's older brother. And David's older brother was a man of war. But he also, like the rest of the nation of Israel, will sit cowering in his tent when everybody else were in the battle line. With everybody else. Let's read what Eli, his older brother, says. Verse 28. Now Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David. And he said, why have you come down, and with what have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle. Eliab was probably a little jealous of David. In 1 Samuel chapter 16, we're told that the prophet, the priest, Samuel comes in there, and he's trying to find a new king. He comes into the house of Jesse, and Jesse brings forth his oldest son. Say, hey, make this one king. And God says, no, I don't want Eliab. So Eliab was probably a little bruised because his youngest brother, David, was now chosen to be king and not him. And besides that, Eliab now hears that his younger brother is saying, hey, I want to go fight this giant Philistine. Eliab sat as a coward. So maybe now he's a little ashamed of his cowardice. And he's angry at David, perhaps because he's saying things that Eliab would not dare to say. So he sits there as a coward and angry as a younger brother. But it's important to note that David's plan, David's intention, David's good intentions aren't going to be changed by the ill will of his brother. He's not going to be thrown off track because this man is going to put him down. He's not going to be thrown off track because he's going to be trying to be put to shame. He is going to remain focused and go to battle. Let's pick up in verse 32. Excuse me for one second. Verse 32. And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. So now David's in front of the king. And he's talking to the king. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. And Saul said to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. You are a young man, and he has been a man of war from his youth. But David said to Saul, your servant used to keep sheep for his father. And when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he rose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant also has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God. And David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hands of Philistine. And Saul said to David, go, and the Lord be with you. How does David's attitude compare to that of King Saul? Where's King Saul been? He's been hiding in a tent. But David says, I can't handle this. They're putting down my God. They're putting down my nation. The weird thing is that Saul seemed to have no problem with this. But David was angry, and he wants to go do something about it. And also you need to note here that David pulls in to share with King Saul what he does as a shepherd. He says, I care for my sheep, King Saul. I care for my sheep more than you do for your people. When a lion or bear comes, I go after that lion and bear. He says, I risk my life for my sheep. He says, I'm a good shepherd. And I want to read to you Psalm chapter 72, verse 14. King Solomon wrote this. From the oppression and violence, he redeems their life. And precious is their blood in his sight. King David realized the preciousness of a few sheep. He realized even more so the preciousness of his God. And he cannot stand this. And as a good shepherd, he wants to go out and do something about it. And again, notice David's tremendous faith in God. He doesn't say, God may save me. He says, the Lord will deliver me. And I know I've shared this quote with you many times, but I think it's such a good quote, I'm going to share it with you again. Edmund Burke once said, evil triumphs when good men do nothing. King Saul sat there in his tent doing nothing. But King David, as he was anointed this time, David would have no part in sitting there. He was going to go to battle. Let's pick up in verse 40.
Then he took his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. You got to also remember at this point, David's picking up 5 smooth stones, because if you want to strike down some huge man, people always make a big deal. Why did he choose 5 stones? I think he chose 5 stones because he was an intelligent man. He knew that if that first one missed, he needed some more. I don't think that shows a lack of faith on David's part. I think it shows intelligence. I think it shows foresight. I think it shows him planning ahead. And he's thinking, if I do miss, I need some more. And he chooses smooth stones because, as we know, nobody wants to shoot a bullet that's not properly shaped, right? It's not going to fly properly. So he wants to choose 5 smooth stones so that when he lets these things fly, they're going to go where he wants them to go. And I want to share with you, before we read any further, I want to share with you a little information about a sling. We're not going to turn there, but if you want to look a little more information about a sling, look at Judges chapter 22 and verse 16. But ancient writers, this is coming from some old other commentaries, other sources, ancient writers tell that there were people who could use a sling and sling rocks with such force that the rock would literally, listen to this, glow with heat in the air. It was going so fast. And some have said, truth or not, I don't know, some have said that sometimes the rocks would literally melt in the air because they were going so fast. And they continue on by saying some of these people who used the slings were so good, they can hit their target at over 600 yards. Anybody who's a hunter knows 600 yards, that's a long ways. 6 football fields. And these guys with slings, they would sling those things with such velocity that the rocks would glow with heat, and they could hit their target from great distances. And so King David goes to battle, and he doesn't just pick something that may work. David is intelligent. He picks a weapon that he's comfortable with. He picks a weapon that he's confident in. And he picks himself 5 stones in case the first one misses. That is not a lack of faith. That's intelligence. Let's pick up again in verse 41. And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. Let's stop for a second. Here's Goliath, this giant of a man, big voice, long-time warrior, muscular probably. Probably looked a lot like me, but big and muscular. Okay, that was a joke. Okay. Here's a huge, scary man. Been a warrior for a long time, defeated a lot of people. And he sees a young man coming to him, and he doesn't even have a shield. He doesn't have a spear. He doesn't have a sword. This man's not been in any battles. He's a young man. And he's a good-looking man. He's cute even. He's like, what are you sending me this cute little guy to fight me for? And he's mad. He's irritated. And he's insulted. And he says, what are you doing? Now let's look at what he says to David, because he is not happy about this. Verse 43. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his God. The Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field. Then David, he's not happy. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and with a spear, with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. So he says, you're coming to me with a weapon, but I'm coming at you with God in my corner. Now, you remember some time ago we read, I think it was in the book of Isaiah, where he talks about that the Lord in the battle roars. It actually says he screams. Now, I talked about Goliath's voice and how intimidating it must be. Again, remember, as intimidating as Goliath's voice must be, imagine God's voice. Imagine the people of Israel when they stood at the bottom of the mountain and they heard God's voice to the point that they were so intimidated, they said, Moses, don't let him talk to us anymore because we're going to die. So Goliath was intimidating, but David realizes, I have God in my corner. He says, I'm coming to you with him on my side. Okay, let's pick up again. We're going to leave off that here. Let's pick up again in verse 45, in verse 46. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head, and I will give the dead bodies, your dead bodies, and I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air, to the wild beasts of the earth. And I want you to stop here as you look at the next half of this verse, from verse 47. And I want you to notice what motivated David to go to battle with Goliath. What was the motivating factor for him to go to battle? Look at this. Halfway through verse 46. That all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Why does he want to go to battle against the Philistines? That the whole world can know there's a God in Israel. You guys worship God. You worship the God of Dagon. You worship other gods. That's not a God. I'm going to battle today so you will know there's a God in Israel. But he doesn't stop there. He wants to teach. He wants to teach other nations, but he wants to do something else too. Look at verse 47. And that all this assembly may know. So he's wanting to teach the nation of Israel something. They needed to be taught something. They were sitting as cowards in tents and on the battle line doing nothing. So David says, and so that this nation can know something as well. What does he want to teach them? Let's finish that verse. And that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves, not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. David wanted to teach his own people that they have not been trusting in God. They have not been trusting the one who can deliver. They've been worried about the sword, the spear, the big giant man. They've been thinking as a man. They've not been thinking as God would have them to think. Let's pick up in verse 48. When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. I want to stop for a second here. I think when it says David ran quickly, I think that's interesting. Everybody else sat cowarding, but David's running to battle. I remember in high school, on Friday nights, 8 o'clock, the battle lines were drawn. And I used to love playing football for this reason. You were so excited about going out there, and in a sense, we were doing a battle. It was a game, but it was a battle, especially in the coach's mind and how they preached it. We were going to battle. We were going to war. And when you believe you can beat somebody, you run out there. And you're excited about the battle that's coming. You want to get busy. You want to get down to the battle. And I remember we'd run out there, and the crowds would be on both sides, and you know they'd be chanting. And we had this paper we'd break through, and it felt good. You were ready for battle. And David has this feeling. He's not sitting back as a coward, intimidated. He's running to battle because he knows he's going to win. Let's pick up at verse 49. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. The stone sank into the forehead, and he fell on his face to the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and struck down the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine, and took his sword, and drew it out of his sheath, and killed him, and cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw their champions were dead, they fled. So David is now overcome, this giant of a man. When I put this sermon title down, I was just curious how many people were going to be thinking when I put a giant of a man, they were going to automatically think of Goliath. But that really wasn't what I was wanting to think of. I was wanting to think of David. Goliath was a giant of a man in stature, but David came out and did battle with somebody because he realized where victory led. He realized who would deliver him. And David wanted to teach his own nation a lesson that their trust was not where it should be. I want to close by reading again another article. This is not an article, it's a story. I got it off the internet. Many of you have probably heard it. And again, it's a little lengthy, but please bear with me. It's called Pennies. And many of you may have already realized you've heard this. And it's called Pennies, In God We Trust. Several years ago, a friend of mine and her husband were invited to spend the weekend at the husband's employer's home. My friend Arlene was nervous about the weekend. The boss was very wealthy and with a fine home on the waterway, and cars costed more than her house. The first day and evening went well, and Arlene was delighted to have this rare glimpse into how the very wealthy live. The husband's employer was quite generous as a host and took them to the finest restaurants. Arlene knew she would never have the opportunity to indulge in this kind of extravagance again, so she enjoyed herself immensely. As the three of them were walking to an exclusive restaurant that evening, the boss was walking slightly ahead of Arlene and her husband. He stopped suddenly, looking down at the pavement for a long, silent moment. Arlene wondered if she was supposed to pass him. There was nothing on the ground except a single, darkened penny that someone had dropped, and a few cigarette butts. Still, silent, The man reached down and picked up the penny. He held it up and smiled and put it in his pocket as if he had found a great treasure. How absurd! What need did this man have for a single penny? Why would he even take the time to stop and pick it up? Throughout dinner, the entire scene nagged at her. Finally, she could stand it no longer. She casually mentioned that her daughter once had a coin collection and asked if the penny he had found had been some value. A smile crept across the man's face as he reached into his pocket and held the penny out for her to see. She'd seen many pennies before. What was the point of this? "Look at it," he said. "Read what it says." She read the words, "United States of America." "No, no, no. Read further." "1 cent?" "No, keep reading." "In God we trust." And, the man replied, "and if I trust in God, the name of God is holy, even on a coin." I want to stop and pause here and say, that's why David could not handle what was going on. He realized the holiness of God's name. And if I trust in God, the name of God is holy, even on a coin. Whenever I find a coin, I see that inscription. It is written on every single United States coin, but we never seem to notice it. God drops a message right in front of me, telling me to trust Him. Who am I to pass it by? When I see a coin, I pray. I stop to see if my trust is in God at that moment. I pick the coin up as a response to God that I do trust Him. For a short time at least, I cherish it as if it were gold. I think it is God's way of starting a conversation with me. Lucky for me, God is patient, and pennies are plentiful. Then the story changes. When I was out shopping today, I found a penny on the sidewalk. I stopped and picked it up, and realized that I had been worrying and fretting in my mind about things I cannot change. I read the word, "In God we trust," and had to laugh. "Yes, God, I get the message. It seems that I have been finding an inordinate number of pennies in the last few months, but then, pennies are plentiful, and God is patient." David wanted to remind the nation of Israel that God is the one we should trust in. God wants us to remember that He's the one that delivers. He's the one that sees us through hard times. When we go through struggles, when we go through trials, when we're faced with things we think we cannot overcome, David wants to remind us that it's God who we should trust in. If there are some here today that are struggling with hard times, they find their faith is not where it should be, they're lacking the trust in God they feel they need to have to see them through this. There's somebody here this morning who has not put the Lord on in baptism, and because of this are still living in their sins. We would like to help you with that. If there's any, for any reason at this time, you would come forward as we sing a song that's been selected.